Pleasure.
Thank you to the Millers. When I drove up, I said, I had a deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra said. I've been here, we've been here before. And we've been here before also, on the cusp of Yom Kippur. So we talk about a topic, the hidden joy of Yom Kippur. Admittedly, there's a part of each and every one of us, probably the largest part of each and every one of us, which is looking towards Yom Kippur as, you know, let's get on the other side already. I was building my sukkah already, thinking, like, you know, I'm on the other side. That's what I was busy doing today. It's a mountain that we have to climb, and a lot of difficulty, especially not eating, being in shul all day long. It's an avoda. It's a big job. So what could possibly be joyous about Yom Kippur? And I'm sure probably you all probably know in some way some answer to that question. Question is, very often I'm speaking with people. I met with a fellow the other day. He said he's smoking for 40 years. And it's not just cigarettes, you know. And I've heard the story also many times before. You know, it's killing me. It's doing this to me. It's, you know, it cost me a lot of money already. And we calculate how much money he spent over the course of the many years. And he's struggling in Parnassa now. So if he had that money that he spent, you know, the whole thing. And he says, so why don't you stop? He says, because it's my good friend. So on the one hand, it's his good friend. You know, on the other hand, I said, this sounds like I'm hearing two different people over here. One part is saying, this is my good friend. And the other part saying, it's my mortal enemy. So, you know, so I'm hearing two different voices. There's two different eyes. There's two different me's that are involved in this conversation. It happens with food. It happens with lots of different things that people are of two minds. Nobody is one thing. Nobody is just one thing. The question is, who are I? Who are we? Who am I? So Nefesh HaChayim takes on a little bit this subject. A famous student of the Vilna Gaon, Reb Chaim Volozhin. And he says that before Adam made a chait, right, when everything was, you know, the world was a perfect place, and man, v'yipach papa v'nishmas chayim, God breathed the breath of life into man, which we reenacted on Rosh Hashanah, that blowing of the shofar was really intersecting with that time when the Almighty had invested and installed eternity into the heart of mankind. So originally, the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, negativity, was something that was only, it was a theoretical thing. It was lurking around on the outside. You know, talk to somebody who grew up in a wholesome home and telling, they could tell them about, you know, a crack house or, you know, or even a discotheque or something like that. Some little kid in Bnei Brak, they said he was watching the fireworks on the 4th of July with an American uncle of his, and he said, oh, Nasa v'nishma. You know, that's when he was watching the lightning. Ba'am roimus akolos, the nation saw the light. You know, he's associating only with innocent, sweet things. If you tell that child that there's a place where people are getting drunk and there's nus there and he would understand there's a possibility. He would hear about it, but it's not something he ever saw and ever experienced. It was on the outside. It was theoretical. And then what happened was, after a person tastes something and they get it into their system, so then all of a sudden it starts to take over. So the person who was smoking, you know, before he ever smoked, it wasn't a part of. Now suddenly it took over his whole being. It started out with a taste and ends up as a chok. Starts out as a tam and ends up with a chok. Starts out with flavor and ends up being something the person can't separate himself from. So the Nefesh HaChayim says that what happened was that the Yetzer Hara moved to the inside and the Yetzer Tov moved to the outside. That's the situation that most of us find ourselves. Reb Dessler says, and one of the proofs of that is just the way we speak about ourselves, the way we refer to ourselves. He says, when we talk about ourselves, we said, you know, oh, I'm hungry. Oh, I'm hungry. You know, when it comes to being hungry or something, it's I'm hungry, you know, with a capital I. But if I did something wrong that I have to rebuke myself as a label, I don't know, why'd you say that? You know, I had an uncle who used to say, my Uncle Al used to say, I only open my mouth to change my feet. Okay? So, you know, but I'll rebuke myself in the second or the third person, but it's not me. It's somehow, it's remote, it's distant from me. It's not me. So it seems that the part that I identify most tenaciously as myself is my physical appetites, my animal desires. That's the me. The spirit seems to be something which is, you know, aloof and remote from our daily experience. Something we have to have a sheer to relate to. It's almost something. It's abstract. It's not concrete. The concrete is the appetite me, and the abstract is the spiritual aspect of our beings. I don't want to be irreverent or indelicate over here, but it's a little bit. I was thinking about how the Flintstones used to open up. Okay, I don't know how many people remember that, right? Remember, I think from 1960 to 1966. I just took a look to see if exactly how it. And that was the introduction where he'd come in, he'd throw the cat out, you know, and then the cat would come out the window, and he would come out and he would lock out and he'd be out there, you know. Will remember that? Okay. If you don't remember. That's okay. You can still get into Olam Haba without knowing about what happened. But what happens is that the animal, the Nefesh Bahamias, back in those days, you know, threw the man out, and the man's locked out of his house, and the cat is on the inside. The animal took over and occupied the house, and now the person finds himself on the outside trying to bang to get in. That's the situation. So the real situation is, I once heard from Rabbi Dr. Greenwald. He said an amazing thing. He spoke to us as yeshiva students, and he said that he went to a conference for psychologists, and he said something that really set everybody on fire. He hit a lot of alarm buttons. He was in his presentation. He used a four-letter word that really. You know, that people they had an allergic reaction to. And that four-letter word was the word soul. Soul. S-O-U-L. You know, and it was a psychologist conference. So they immediately converged upon him after his talk, and they said, you know, Dr. Greenwald, you don't believe that you have a soul, do you? You know, because we think of it as an abstract, some kind of a interesting hypothesis, but it's not something that. And he said, no. He says, you're right. He says, I don't believe I have a soul. And I said, oh, you see, you speak about it publicly, but then, you know, when we confront you privately, you know, you beg away. He says, no. He says, I believe I am a soul and I have a body. You know, so, and that's how he lived his life. This is a person who's living a soulful life with a soul has now been firmly implanted on the inside. And he's taking control of his life. So that's really the goal of Yom Kippur. And as a matter of fact, the Talmud in the Masechtas Nedarim gives a very, very important strategic piece of information. I'm not big on gematrias, okay? When I listen to a number, someone leaves me a message with a number, I have listened to the message 14 times, you know. Numbers go through me like empty calories. I like numbers, but sometimes I just can't pay attention to them. They don't mean that much to me. My wife will tell you when it comes to paying the bills and these type of things. Numbers, that's not, you know, it's not my thing. But every once in a while, if I catch a meaningful gematria, wow. So the Talmud says like this, the gematria, the Talmud says it. So it's not just something, you know, somebody playing around with numbers. I was just thinking about the other day. I was thinking about Ma'ashiv. How can I return to? How can I pay back Hashem? David HaMelech asked. Is the gematria Sameach? You know, that's the having a glad heart. Okay. Someone else told me that the word the gematria for Ezer Kenegdo. I was at a wedding and this felt of Ezer Kenegdo, the helpmate that's against a wife. He says the opposing but yet helping wife is gematria 360 because she gives him the 360 degree perspective. So every once in a while I catch a gematria that makes sense to me. This one, the Talmud says that the gematria of Hasatan, this opposing force in life, this generic opposing force that seduced Adam and Chava and wreaks havoc in the world, that the gematria is 364. Okay? Very nice. So how does that help us? So here we have an important military secret over here. Tell everybody, okay? It'll still be a secret. So what's the importance of knowing that it's 364? So the commentaries say that the Yetzer Hara is active and he's trying to gain ground 364 days in the solar year. But there's one day when he is, you know, whatever installations he's made. So he stays with that, and he goes into a somnambulous state of mind, and he falls asleep, and he's not active. He's stuck in his chair. And that day happens to be Yom Kippur. I can actually prove to you mathematically that the Yetzer is quiet on Yom Kippur. Mathematically. Right? How mathematically? Because the most difficult thing for a man to say, the three most important words in marriage is not "I love you." Okay, that actually flows off the lips very easily, very often. The three most important words are "I was." Thank you for helping me. I appreciate it. It's very difficult for me to say it. Okay, you know, if for a person to say that "I was wrong," for a person to admit that they did something wrong, it's, you know, forget about it. You know, a person go lifetimes and not admit and double down and justify, not be just, but justify, rationalize, not be rational, but rationalize and do all these different intellectual gymnastics, but never admit that you did something wrong. And here on Yom Kippur, you've got people sitting over there banging their hearts all day long saying, "I did it, I did it." Even things I didn't do, I did. No, we did it, we did it, we did it, we did it. Guilty, 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 guilty as charged. It's unbelievable. So it must be that the Yetzer Hara is quiet on that day. So what can we do if we know that the Yetzer Hara is not going to be around on that day, if he's not going to be active? And the idea is, since he moved into our house and he set up and he, you know, put his magazines and his, you know, things around, and he's leaving his sneakers in the middle of the room, his coffee cup, and he made himself comfortable, and instead of, you know, tiptoeing around and saying, "Excuse me, I don't want to move his stuff and I don't want to start up with him," on that day, what would you do? Hire a moving truck, right? That's the day. We hire a moving truck on Yom Kippur. And what we do is we start to take his stuff and we put into boxes. Ashamnu, Begadnu, Gazalnu, the Barnu Dofi, all these different things. And we start to load it onto the truck. And the last thing before the end of the day, we say, "Oh yeah, you know something? There he is sleeping in the chair in the middle of the room, you know? We take this gorilla and we put him into the truck, and then we turn on the truck and we face it towards the cliff, and we start the engine, and we jump out of the thing, and we let him go down to the bottom of the cliff like the Seir Lazaza, like that goat that goes to the bottom of the cliff, and we watch him burst into flames. Then we come back and we make sure we lock the door and put the chain across and say, you know, not welcome back anymore. That's the joy of Yom Kippur, is that we have a chance to reclaim our own existence. That's the freedom that happens on Yom Kippur. And it takes a day where we're not busy eating, we're not busy drinking, we're not busy being distracted with earning a livelihood. We're dedicated that whole day to this whole, to moving. Just happened last year I moved. Moving is a big day. Moving is a big job. But you want to make sure you don't forget anything. And this day, we're moving this whole system that became so entangled in our life and so entwined into our being, and we're picking them up and we're moving them out. I remember one of my rebbeim said, and it's entangled in subtle ways. I remember one of my rebbeim telling me, he's a powerful person. He just passed away this also the past year. Rabbi Israel Tauber. We used to learn every morning for like 6 or 7 years, and I would always get a coffee for him and a coffee for me. We sit down, we start learning Maharal, all the Sifrei Machshava, all the great stuff we learned together. Went through many, many incredible things, Masechtas together. And I got him a coffee one time, and he said, "No, he's not taking a coffee." I said, "Why, Rebbe? Why not coffee? You know?" He said, "No. He took a hot water and he put a little dab of milk in it. He said, I'm having a white coffee." I said, "Okay." I said, and the reason? He says, I found out that the coffee is drinking me. That's what he said. He said he was a wealthy person. He was a Talmud Chacham. He was, you know, and he had an incredible personal charisma and power. He said, but the coffee is drinking me. He said, the coffee has control of me. I didn't know exactly what he meant. It sounded like a nice quippy thing. But then later on, I saw a very beautiful moshel from Rabbi Yozel Horowitz, the Alter from Nevardak. And he said like this. He says, let's say a fella says, "I'm under control. I'm under control in this area." Everybody's got different areas. You know, I drink a little bit in the morning, and I drink a little bit in the afternoon, and then I check my emails, but I only check this, and then I look on YouTube for this, and I only read this by the paper, but I only read the sports page, and these four, five sections, and that's it, you know. But otherwise, I'm under control, you know, and I only go shopping, and I spend this money. Everybody's got certain areas where people say, you know, like, hey, slow down. What do you have? You're spending your whole day like this. No, no, I'm under control. And we say, you know, alcoholic, the smoker. I only smoke 3 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, and that's it. But I'm under control. He says, so if you're so under control, so stop. So Rabbi Yosef Yosel Horowitz says, he says, let's say you see your friend Chaim walking down the street. He's got 2 giant policemen on either side. And they look like they're escorting him off to prison. He said, Chaim, what happened? What did you do wrong? He said, no. He said, you understand? He said, I'm taking them to jail. I'm escorting them. He says, if what you say is right, that you're actually escorting them and they're not pulling you, then take 10 steps or 12 steps, right, in the other direction, and see if you can walk away from them without them clobbering on the head. If a person can't stop, if I can't stop drinking my coffee for a couple of days, then it could be that the coffee is actually, I think I'm drinking the coffee is drinking me. I think I'm watching the news, but the news is watching me. I think I'm shopping at the mall, but the mall is shopping me. Because I can't let go, because it's not me. It has a pull. It has a hold on me. It has a spell on me. And I can't let go. So the ability to let go, the ability to be free from something, not to be that this thing, here's this powerful person, he felt he had a ring in his nose, and he's being led around by a cup of caffeine. And he says, I want to be able to declare myself free even in this small area of life. On Yom Kippur, we want to be able to declare ourselves that we are free. Free. Yom Kippur is about gaining freedom. Matter of fact, the declaration that was made, and the declaration that's on the Liberty Bell, the declaration that was made right after Yom Kippur to let all the slaves go in the 50th year was the declaration that's on the Liberty Bell, let freedom ring. It's a day of great freedom. The day of such restriction is the day actually that brings the most amount of freedom. So they asked Michelangelo one time, he said, how is it that you were able to carve out of that block of stone, you know, that beautiful, ornate picture of a statue of that figure of David? And he said, very simple. He says, I cut away everything that wasn't David. Okay, that's what he did. He went to approach the marble. He said, anything that's not David, I get rid of. And the same thing, anything that's not labeled, Pesal Lacha, the anniversary of the giving of the second tablets, where Moshe Rabbeinu was told, Pesal Lacha, carve out for yourself. Basalacha, carve yourself out. That was the anniversary of the giving that happened on Yom Kippur. And so the message over there is that we're meant to carve ourselves out, to remove the things that are not necessarily that we don't identify as ourselves. We have a mixed bag of stuff that we did, and certain things I would rather not be identified with, and certain things I would rather be identified with. So we do tshuva on those things that we want to disassociate ourselves with. A child goes into the water and he's bathing himself. And certain things, the dirt is falling off and all kinds of other crusty things are falling off. You know, that's the bath water. But this is the baby, but you're left with a clean baby in the end. We're getting rid of the things that I don't want to be associated with this thing, ultimately. And these other things, I want to highlight them and say, this is who I am. This is who I identify myself as. I think that the most sober moments in the whole year look like the craziest moments. I remember this year we go to a hotel. Every year we go to a hotel for Yom Kippur. I remember a number of years ago where I daven is there's a door that leads out to a hallway, which is, you know, where the hotel staff is moving about. They're moving things around there. I can often hear what's going on there. We're in the middle of Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur. And we got a room full of people who are all, you know, in the men's section, they're all wearing white kitlach, and they're all at that point crying, Hashem Elokim, Hashem Elokim. And they're crying, and they're pounding the chest, and the place is rocking with emotion. And some guy, I just remember this moment, this guy opened up the door, this Spanish guy, he looks in. And I remember thinking about what he's thinking about, you know, in that moment. When he, you know, what is he thinking about? It was a distracting moment. But what is he thinking about? What's going on? He probably thinks, this is a base of sugar. This is a crazy house. I just stepped into an insane asylum. I swerved into oh my gosh, look at these people, these adults over there. You know, and what he saw in that, I saw him scan the room over there like, and he closed the door. But then I had to recover myself. I said, yeah, he thinks it's a crazy moment. I said, but this is the most sane moment of the entire year. It could be that the rest of the year that we are certified crazy. Because at that moment over there when we're saying Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem is reality. That's reality. And I think the other sober moment, the other clear-minded moment of the whole year, will go to the other end of the spectrum. In the middle and the height of the Suda on Purim, after we had a couple of good drinks. And everybody's dancing around like Yehudim, like Yehudim, and then someone comes in and you say some fellow and you give him a hug, yeah, the Jew. And we feel such a hava, and the money comes out of the pocket. And when the wine goes in, the truth comes out. And somehow the inner reality of who we are and what we're about now suddenly is manifest at that moment over there. Because that's who we are. That's the reality. Suddenly the true us is now the David has been revealed. And all the other stuff has been made secondary, is lost. Remember I heard from Rabbi Israel Tauber. He was my Rebbe for so many years, and I started going into the city to learn with business people. And I never forget that I asked him one day, I said, I'm starting to go into the city, and I'm a little concerned that I'm going to get affected by everything that's around me. I want to sort of remain focused. It's easy to do it when you're in yeshiva. It's easy to do it when you're in Muncie sometimes. But when I'm going to go into Manhattan, it's not going to be so easy. I'm afraid I'm going to become like the area that I occupy all day long. He gave me an unbelievable advice that I'm following to this very day. That's how many, 20 some odd years later, 30 years later. He says, go to the mikveh every day. So I go to the mikveh every day. I started going. It means I have to get up 15 minutes earlier because I'm on my way to the bus. I got to get 15 minutes earlier to go into the mikveh. And it costs a few dollars too. And I go to the mikveh. I started going to the mikveh that year. Maybe once or twice I missed. But the days that I missed, it was like a day that it was flat. There was no fuzz in the seltzer that day. But the days that I went, I felt like I was like a hot knife cutting through butter. I felt I was focused. I felt I could always renew myself no matter what happened the next day. I said, it was unbelievable. The Rambam calls it Meidas, the waters of knowledge. And I said, wow, this was powerful, important advice, and I felt great about it. Then came the whole year went round, and it was Yom Kippur. And in Yom Kippur, don't go to the mikveh. One of the five things that we refrain from doing is washing ourselves, bathing ourselves. I didn't go to the mikveh on Yom Kippur. And here we had a davening that we don't take a 2-hour break or a 3-hour break. We took a 20-minute break right before Ne'ilah. 20 minutes. That was it. We went through mincha, 20 minutes. It was a real yeshiva davening, 20 minutes till Ne'ilah. In those 20 minutes, this one put his head down. That one, I went over to my Rebbe and I said, I feel bad. I said, I missed the mikveh today. And Rabbi Israel Tauber looked at me, he says, if you missed the mikveh today, he said, then you don't know what the whole day is about. And here I am, I'm thinking to myself, here I just spent a whole day, there's 20 minutes left in the Ila, and that's another, an hour or 45 minutes, and I don't know what the day is about. What? I better find out what I'm doing today, and here it is, the day is almost over. What have I been working so hard for? He says, if you think you need to go to the mikveh today, he said, then you don't know what the whole day is about. He says, you're in the mikveh. On Yom Kippur, we're in the mikveh. Mikveh Yisrael Hashem, the mikveh of the Jewish people. We say in the last Mishnah in Yoma, the quote Rabbi Akiva, the mikveh of the Jewish people is Hashem. We're tovling in Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. We're in the next world already. We're tovling in Hashem. And He's cleansing us with a universal solution, with a universal cleansing agent, which is called Tshuva. He's bathing us. We're being bathed by Hashem. We're tovling in Hashem. We're immersing ourselves in Hashem. That's the day. I never lost that image. Yom Kippur now means something completely different. The rest of that day and every Yom Kippur since then, I imagine I'm toddling and I'm in the mikveh. I'm in the mikveh of Hashem. The best mikveh of all. And that's what's happening on Yom Kippur. That's the dynamic. That's the joy of Yom Kippur is that we're revealing ourselves on Yom Kippur. We're becoming more ourselves. We're becoming who we really are, who we're meant to be. Deep in our insides, that's what we're becoming. Now I'm going to say something, and I apologize, because it's not going to sound like, how could you say that? How can you say that? But I remember, this past year we had, my mother was with us for Sukkot time. I just built a Sukkot again. I tell my wife, Bubby was here last year. My mother was a part of JEP for many, many years. And she tripped. She didn't recover. Now, we knew she fell. We thought she'd bounce up. We didn't know she'd bounce up that high. She's in the next world now. And there was Zadie. I remember Zadie working in the Westchester Hebrew Day School for so many years. Mr. Fuhr. I don't know how many people remember Mr. Fuhr from the crowd of here. So he had a stroke. He was in his 80s. He had a stroke. And there were family members that were around, not from our immediate family, who said, you know, we got approached by the committee, they call it the ethics committee in the hospital. And they said, you know, why don't we just, you know, forget about feeding and forget about, you know, hydration, and, you know, and we'll just set the date, you know, because a person can only last so long without water, and that'll be the merciful way. And there were relatives who bought into it who said, you know, this is not quality of life. He wouldn't want that. And I'm saying to myself, and thank God we were able to win the day. I remember Rabbi Zajic went many times to visit, you know, right up to the very end also. I said, this is not quality of life. Okay, so you're not sitting in a restaurant and drinking wine and talking with friends, and you're not, you know. He says, but the person sitting inside with a pulse and a brain, and electricity going through the brain, and they're going through the tapes of their life, and they have a chance to say, I don't want to take to eternity, and this I would like to, you know, jettison. This I would like to identify with, and that could be the most special moments of a person's entire life over there. Is that, no, I'm not getting up out of this bed over here. I'm stuck over here. I'm resigned. I'm resolved, but I'm going through this deep. And someone say, "Oh, that's not quality of life." I'm thinking to myself, and I didn't know how to explain to them. You know, we were able to overcome with some other discussions, but to me, I said, "That is quality of life." You're underneath the talus. You're underneath 1,000 talus, talasim over there. And the person's going through their heart. And who knows, somebody who would interrupt that process is interrupting something very, very important, because the pay later plans are always much more expensive than the pay now plans. And if a person can do that tshuva while they're here, the Talmud says, Yafa sha'acha shel tshuva maisim tovu ba'olam hazeh mikol chay olam haba. From all the enjoyment of the next world is one moment of tshuva and maisim tovim in this world. And in Yom Kippur, we have 25 hours. When I was a kid, my father used to run the concession at Yankee Stadium. I went many times to Yankee Stadium, thousands of times. And I have some special memories of being there on Old Timers Day. And they would call out some of the great players of, you know, from this team and that team, you know, and the guys don't fit into the uniforms quite anymore. And they come chugging out to the sideline and they give like a wave to the crowd. But I saw a few times, if I was there, live, in the building, when they would call out the Dodger catcher, who had, I think, won a couple of batting championships and won a couple of World Series championships. Anybody know what I'm talking about yet? Okay, they would call, Roy Campanella. He was in California, he was in a car accident. He became a quadriplegic. And they would wheel him out, this adoring fellow, onto the field. He couldn't move his hands. He couldn't move his legs. He could just survey with his eyes. And the people would be mahana him. They would bathe him with a 15, 20-minute ovation. And they knew that they were putting salve on his soul. They knew they were uplifting him. They knew that they were giving him pleasure. To me, it was like, wow, that's unbelievable. If we want to have a flavor, Rabbi Miller says, of what the Rabbi Avigdor Miller says, of what the next world, he says, pass by a stadium, you hear the roar of the stadium. But this was something more than just a roar in the stadium. This was 60,000 people now washing this fellow and giving him an uplift and making him feel like this is Gan Eden. This is Gan Eden. But I was thinking, the Mishnah says, like this, it says that one chorus ruach, one exhaust fan experience of the next world, is not equal to all the pleasure that's in this world. And yet, in the same mission, it says, "Yafa sha'acha shel tshuva maisim tovim ba'olam hazeh mikol chay olam haba." One moment of tshuva and maisim tovim, of doing tshuva in this world, is equal to all the next world. I said, "How can you reconcile that?" And I was thinking to myself that if you would ask Roy Campanella at that moment over there, "Are you enjoying this? Isn't this something?" Yeah, I said. Then you ask him, "Is this what you want?" He says, "No, I'd rather be able to put the uniform on and play one more game." You know, just let me get up, let me stand up and get a bat in my hand, you know, and have the thrill of, you know, even if I strike out, but let me have the thrill of swinging at it, having one more whack at it, and see if maybe I can drill a single to the right field, maybe I can put one over the left field fence, you know, and get a cheer that way, in a legitimate way. I'm not looking to cash in. So as much as, you know, Olam Haba is a great thing, but playing in this world and having that opportunity to do that action over there, that is like playing the game of life. So I think that is quality of life. So even if a person looks like he's sitting on the bench, you know, and he's waiting and he's in the dugout, but we have a chance to get up on the field, we have a chance to play. That is called real playing. That's what I would like to say. Maybe we'll just finish up with this story, and then open up to any questions. I think this summarizes why Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur lead up to Sukkot. I just finished building my Sukkot. Now I'm going to identify what's going on in the Sukkot. We're sitting over there. Zman Simchasenu, the time of our great happiness, is going to immediately follow Yom Kippur. So there's a famous story about a fella, a teacher, whatever, didn't have much money. He needed to marry off his daughter. Okay, it's always a certain price. 10,000 rubles seem to be the standard price. I don't think much has changed since then, you know. And where's he going to get the money? He had tried to borrow from some friends. He tried a little business. Nothing happened. He was not successful. The wedding date is coming closer. He's got pressure. So he takes a long journey to visit his rabbi. Once he goes to visit his rabbi, the rabbi's sitting over there. Did you try business? Yes. Did you try borrowing? Yes. Do you have any relatives? Yes. I tried all of them. Dead ends. I'm not able to do it. What do I do? So his Rebbe, very big tzaddik, says, okay, reaches into his pocket, he's waiting to see what's going to come out with. He comes out with a ruble, he needs 10,000, puts it in his hand, and says, the first chance you have to get into business, he says, to buy something, buy. Ah, beautiful. So the fellow now, you know, heads out with a ruble in his hand. Okay, he's still way short of his magic number, but at least, you know, with his emunah and his Rebbe, and he has a piece of advice to begin with. He has the seed of a future. So he parks, he goes on his way back. It's not a one-day journey. He didn't have a Toyota, you know, to get back home. So he stops in an inn, and he's sitting over there, and he's got his books, and he's saying his devotions, and his Dafayomi, and Tehillim, and Marav. That's a group of guys who are smoking cigars and laughing it up, yucking it up, you know, kibitzers, you know. And they see this fellow over there, so one of the head kibitzers comes over, leaves the card game, comes over and says, what are you doing? Where are you from? He tells him where he's from. What are you doing here? He says, well, I'm a teacher. And, well, actually, I'm a businessman. He reminds himself what the Rebbe said. He says, what kind of businessman? He goes, I don't know. You don't know what kind of businessman you are? He said, are you buying or selling? He says, well, actually, I'm buying. Yeah. He says, well, how much have you got to invest? You know, going to stores, sometimes they ask you, like, well, what are you looking to spend? You know, he says, a ruble. The guy says, a ruble. What are you, you're a businessman and you're investing a ruble? So he says, what do you hope to buy for a ruble? The fellow thinks to himself, he says, you know something? I'm going to separate this fellow from his ruble. He says, I got something I want to sell you. He says, yeah, what do you want to sell me? Remember the Rebbe said, the first chance you get a chance to buy something, buy it. He says, I'd like to sell you my chelik and olam haba, my portion in the next world. He goes, okay. The fellow says, okay, give me the ruble. He says, no, we have to write up a contract. So he sits down, they write up, I do bequeath you hereby with all the legal jargon, you know, until he has the fellow sign. He rolls up the paper, puts it in his pocket, he gives the fellow a ruble. The fellow goes back to the card game, the cigars disappear, the drinks are finished, the game is over, he goes up to his wife, and his wife is sitting there, and he's laughing, he says, are you still up? Yeah, he says, I have to tell you, there's a guy down there, and I got a ruble from him. He says, yeah, how do you do it? Because I sold him my portion of the next world. Ah, he said he's a businessman. And she's not laughing. He says, don't you get it? I sold him my portion of the next world, and I got... You don't get it? He says, yeah, I get it. The only thing I remember, my parents told me we're not so religious. They told me you have to marry a Jewish person, a Jewish man, and call Yisrael Yeshlem Chelik L'Olam Haba. Every Jew has a portion of the next world, and if you haven't got a portion of the next world, then you're not Jewish. So I can't stay here anymore. I'm going back to my parents. He goes, what are you getting? So he says, okay, I'll go back down there and I'll undo the deal. He goes back downstairs. And he finds the fellow. He says, oh, you're still here? Thank God. He said, here's the ruble back. You know, let's tear up the contract. The fellow says, my Rebbe told me to buy. He didn't tell me to sell. He goes, oh, I see. You're a tough businessman. He fishes around his pocket. He pulls out another ruble. He says, here's another ruble. You made 100% profit and just, you know, in 2 hours over here. He says, wow, you are a good businessman. He says, no, again, I'm not bargaining with you. I'm not handling. My Rebbe told me to buy. He never told me to sell. He says, I'll give you 10 rubles. My wife is about to leave me. You don't understand. I'm in a desperate corner over here. He says, you got to give me that document back and we have to void the sale. He says, I'm sorry, I can't. we have to go visit the Rebbe. He says, where's the Rebbe? He says, he's a half a day's journey back in another direction. He goes, okay, we're going to wake up in the morning, the daven, and they head back to this rabbi. They go back to the rabbi. And they stand in front of him, and they have a din Torah. And the rabbi asked the rabbi, he said, what should he sell it back to him for? And after hearing all the sides, the rabbi says, I think you should sell the portion back to him, sell him back to his portion next world, for 10,000 rubles. He goes, what? 10,000 rubles? His wife hits him with the elbow. Oh, okay. Yeah, you know. He writes out a check for 10,000 rubles. He hands it over to the fellow and says, okay. Oseh shalom ben ramav. We say, thank you very much. You know. And he goes back to marry his daughter. And meanwhile, this fellow is walking out. And his wife is telling him, I told you, you talk to strangers and you get into problems and you with your mouth and it's too much. She's giving him sheva brachas. Oh, she's working him over big time. When they get outside, he says, I have to go back and talk to the rabbi. He says, I'm really annoyed about this. He says, I got to go ask him a question. So he comes back into the room and he sits there with the rabbi. He says, tell me. He says, my portion in the next world is really worth 10,000 rubles. You know, maybe I just got ripped off over here. Is it really worth 10,000 rubles? And the rabbi tells him like this. He says, I have to tell you, my friend, when you sold your portion in the next world for 1 ruble, he says, it wasn't even worth 1 ruble. He said, but when you bought it back for 10,000 rubles, it's worth more than you can ever possibly imagine now. So when a person sells themselves short by cashing in on the neshama for some small, brief pleasure in this world, and they forget about Hashem, and they forget about eternity, and they forget about the ultimate good in life and what we're here for and who we really are, he says, they cheapen themselves and they cheapen the stock in their being. But when we buy it back for 24, 25 hours of tshuva, not just the sha'acha shel tshuva and ma'aseh tov, we buy it back and we say, this is who we are and this is who we want to be, then our stock goes up beyond anything that we could possibly imagine. That's what it's all about. And the schach that we put on top of us, it's when a person does tshuva from ahava, then even the mistakes we made are turned into mitzvahs. And therefore the schach is the leftovers from the granaries and the wineries. It's the stuff that was thrown away, the stuff that was lost, the time that we lost, the time that we wasted, it was the things that we did. All that comes back to visit us when we do tshuva, and that's the great possibility of tshuva on Yom Kippur. When a person would win the lottery and earn $1 million, what would he be happy if a person earned $1 million, suddenly it would come flying into his lap, or if he thought he lost $1 million and he left it in a bag on the subway and he thought it was gone, his life savings, and then suddenly someone came back and said, some honest fellow says, we found your bag and it's over here and it has your name on it, you know, and he said, oh, wow. Which would bring more dancing to a person's feet if he worked his whole life for a bag of money and he thought he lost it and now suddenly he found what was really his, or if suddenly he got gifted from the outside for $1 million. So Zman Simcha Seinu is we're recovering, and we have the joy of recapturing that which we thought we lost, which was the good times of our lives, the good hours and the good moments of our lives. So Yom Kippur is a very, very powerful and amazing opportunity that we have. And again, there's a part of my body over here which is saying, no food, you know. I know my 60 trillion cells go on strike, especially the brain cells, you know, when I don't get my coffee in the morning. You know? But once we work ourselves past it and we get to later on in the day, then suddenly we've left our bodies behind, and suddenly anything that's not labeled, you know, is not speaking over there, is not present in that room over there. And we long and we live for those golden moments over there. Those are the golden moments of life that we're going to be able to produce with the work that we're going to be doing together. We're doing it together, even though we'll probably be in different rooms and different places, but everybody's pulling together. All the Jewish people, all pulling together in different rooms. We're all pounding our hearts, but pounding and trying to wake up something good on the inside, so that when we're standing there, we've cut away everything that's not us, and we're standing in front of Hashem with only that which is essential, that which was the real who we are. So wish everybody a gemar chesima tova, a good gebench to yor, and what I'm going to maybe finish up with a poem I wrote a number of years ago that's called A Fast, Fast Day. I don't know why fast days are called fast days. You know, that's a total misnomer, you know. The days go very slow, fast days, you know, so it must be coming from some other place. But of all the names to give a day that you're not eating, a fast day, hello. But Yom Kippur is a fast, fast day. Let's say, the open door as the blink of an eye is Yom Kippur. Let's ask ourselves why. While Hashem tends ear to discern our mumble, what does he hear but a stomach's grumble? So we dawdle away with idle chatter, such an awesome day of grievous matter. till the winds of time slam airtight the Shari Shemayim, the gates of heaven, Yom Kippur night. But with one great sigh before it's too late, a tear-drenched eye might rust that gate and cause a brief pause in that second while we plead our cause for fast reconcile. In that last instant pinch, the closing while, we yield an inch, he grants a mile. Now measure the worth, acknowledge the wrong. Why on earth do we wait so long? With one full day by an open door, if we'd start to pray, we'd achieve much more. Wishing everybody a democracy that's open day. Anybody? Any questions? Anything? Even hard questions. Yes. Yeah, sure.
You mentioned your gratitude to Rabbi Kalva.
Yes.
Who, I had the privilege of knowing him, and I'm in awe of Rabbi Kalva. And you mentioned how grateful you were that he gave you a suggestion about how to maintain your purity, even though you were entering an environment that you felt was not the best place to be in. We often travel in such environments, and perhaps you have a suggestion for us that we could implement to, in our journey in life, help us maintain that level of purity and not be influenced by everything going on around us and all the people we interact with.
I have a brief suggestion over here. I'm carrying it with me myself. You know, as much as I have a staff of teachers and I have students around me, the one I have to take control of and manage to make sure that I have to give the most important report card on is to myself. There's such a thing called Cheshbon HaNefesh. There's a sefer called Cheshbon HaNefesh. There's a sefer. There's a shar, another. And sefer Cheshbon HaNefesh outlines, he said, if a person would just make a short list of things and grade themselves. It's very easy with a computer these days with Word. I created inserted a graph 6-7 days a week. And over here I have, different things to work on. And every week is something, here. I mean, this week over here, shalom. Get along with everyone. So I'm focused on this one, but last week I minored in Seder. Stay organized, think ahead, I give myself either a check or an X, depending upon how I'm doing, just to be self-aware of what it is that I'm here to work on. Everybody makes it. Just even the making up of this list is very, very powerful exercise. This is what I need to work on. Everybody's got something in their life that they need to work on for the rest of their life. Everybody. I didn't need anybody yet. That doesn't have something that if I would be able to roll that rock and reveal, then I would truly discover myself. Remember, Rabbi Tauber told us that he had a very cruel nature. And he said, in the overcoming of that cruelty, he became a tremendous Baal Chesed. He became somebody who was able to do an enormous amount of Chesed. But he felt that that he had to overcome it. There's something that if we would work on it and be aware of it, and there's a few things that we have to maintain on a daily basis, and if we would just have a piece of paper. Sometimes you think you do it on the computer and on the phone, but it's something good about having a piece of paper that you look at and you put a mark on it. And there's a lot of other things. If I come up with a phrase or an interesting phrase or an idea that somebody said, I put it down on this piece of paper and I put it into a three in a notebook. So if we can find a way to grade ourselves on a daily basis and on a weekly basis to see how I'm doing in these two areas, three areas, four areas. Cheshbon HaNefesh says 13 areas. It sounds very ambitious. It sounds like a lot, but just kept sitting down and said, which areas, if I worked in this thing, I would improve my life. Maybe sometimes I'm a little down. I have to work on simcha. Fake it till you make it. Even smile though your heart is breaking. Be in a good mood even if there's a value to it. Not disingenuous. Sometimes if you do it from the outside, you work through, and suddenly you become happy. That's what the Mesillas Yesharim says. So there's a value to all these different things. Menuchas HaNefesh is one of my big things. Not to react. I've written all over the place. Act, don't react. No matter what happens, no matter what somebody says to you, no matter surprise, this thing happens. Okay, we'll get to it in a moment. Not right this minute. I have to make sure I'm going to do the right thing. I'm not going to be a reactor to anything that's happening. I have to be an actor in every situation. Let me figure out what the optimal right thing to do is, but to curb that first instinct. Everybody's got a list of things. I got my list of things over here, and maybe that could be the same thing as going into a mental mikveh, just having a way of checking ourselves. Sometimes you have to put an X over there. Lashon hara, 3, 4, 5 X's. But once you see it, like I was driving over here, they had a sign that said I was going a little too fast on one of these roads over here, and it said, slow down, you know, like, you know. I don't need a policeman to arrest me. I just have to be aware that I was traveling a little fast. I'm going 45, and it's a 30-mile-an-hour zone. You know, and suddenly I see the light, you know, a light flashing. When I see those X's, the next day there's few. There's fewer. There could be something like that. It might be very useful and very helpful. That's one suggestion.
If anybody's interested, the classic work, Tezbon on Nefesh, Rabbi Lam referred to, I have a new copy of that work. If anybody would like to take a look at it, it's extremely practical, down to earth.
And you're not beating yourself up. You're just being aware. That's all. If I violate something, I'm just aware. And I don't have to. I don't need to. You know, I don't have to hit myself. You know, kabang on the head. Just have to know what. And I know why I got into this. So, you know, I give myself an X. That's it. I put a dot over there. You know, food, this, that, a few different areas. But once I know that I see that I'm going, then all the wheels are facing in the right direction. Then I feel like I'm doing what I should be doing. So it's a way of just sort of self-reflecting on ourselves without fooling ourselves all day long. Doesn't mean I can't fool myself. There's all kinds of holes in the system. I have to find other ways to fill it in also. So we got a lot of work to do, but that's why Hashem gave us all this time. Baruch Hashem. All right. Again, Gemar Chesima Tova. Thank you very much for opening up your home. Really appreciate it. And next year in Yerushalayim, next year in Yerushalayim, we can taste it already. Can't we taste it? Can we taste it? The baby's head is down. We're ready. We're ready. We're ready. Something's happening. The world is pregnant with something. We're pushing in the birthing room. We're pushing. We're pushing. We're pushing. We're pushing. And we're gonna hear it. We're gonna hear it. I can feel it in my bones.
Well, we want to thank Rabbi Lam for his phenomenal inspiration.